this is just off the record, just if you wanted, but I think really that to get a feel for what has happened in the growth and development of the law school, you should go to Sally, who apparently you've done a lot of work with on this, and she as a librarian is excellent, and she will have all of these things at her fingertips for you. But what you should ask her for is the catalogs that were published each year of law school. This is the catalog. I don't know what date this is, but this is a catalog that was recent, very recently, last year or two, was sent out to all students who, undergraduate students who were considering law schools. And this is their first contact, in many instances, with what we have to offer, do you see, what we tell them in this catalog. And there is a lot of good information that may have been of interest to you in the catalogs, which gives you each year the people who are on the faculty, and also, well, this one doesn't do it, but earlier catalogs gave the list of all of the students who were in the students in the school by year and by source of origin, where they came from, and so forth.
Now, was the law school publishing its own catalog when you arrived?
Yes, but it wasn't much of a catalog, to be quite honest with you. I mean, it was a very
because this simple, is very impressive
simple affair. But really, you ought to get the catalog that was here when I came here in 68. Look at the catalog in 68, and you can take that with you.
Thank you.
At the catalog that was in use in 1968, and you see, Sally will have those things in her file in the library archives. Tell her to pull the catalogs that were published each year for the first few years, and then maybe sample some in the last 6 or 8 years. Do you see? It will tell you better than I ever could the growth and development that took place in our law school, both from the standpoint of the richness and diversity of the student body that developed from the time in 1968 when I came here until the present day. And we'll tell you about the growth of the faculty over that period of time, who some of the faculty, who the faculty were each year, and also we'll give you a description of the programs that were in the law school. Over the years, we've developed a lot of new programs and student activities. And if you just sit down with those catalogs, you're going to see all of the development that took place, do you see, over those years. And then if you would also, from the standpoint of the placement thing, which has been very important to us, the fact that we've been able to develop and broaden our placement opportunities for our students as they graduate start with the fact that we had nothing when I came here in 1968, really, to try to, in a formal way, assist our students in employment. And then go over to the placement office and talk to the placement. Unfortunately for you, the placement director, who was here for a number of years, has resigned and left to go to Richmond. But she could have given you a good picture of that. I don't know who's in there right now. But go in there and talk to the placement persons there and ask them to try to give you an idea, they must have it in their files, as to when the placement operation really first got underway there. This was all under my aegis, but I can't remember all this. When the placement office first got into operation, and then have them kind of trace for you the development that's taken place there. My goodness, ask about the number of law firms we have come in here year after year. We have dozens and dozens and dozens who come in.
That's quite a development from nothing to dozens and dozens.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the richness and diversity of the student body. Now, I understand that you are single-handedly responsible for that, because you used to recruit by individual.
Right. And I, when I came to the law school, there, I think we had one black student, and of course no women. And that was the only black student who'd ever been in the law school. And one of my objectives when I came, and I told President Huntley as much, was that I intended to try to develop representation of minorities in the student body. And also I told him that I would keep the pressure on him to let the law school have women in the law school. And so he knew from the time he hired me that those were some conditions on which I was coming into the job. And he was always very cooperative in all of this. And I did do the best I could to expand the minority representation in the law school, and we finally were successful in being permitted to admit women to the law school.
Tell me about those programs. I mean, that's
well, the program, and also I was anxious to have us have more variety in the demographics and backgrounds of our students. When I came here, most of them were from Virginia, and the majority of them were from VMI and from Washington and Lee. And I knew that we were going to mount to things at law school, we'd have to have more demographic diversity than that. And so, yes, I worked very hard at trying to expand our contacts with undergraduate schools to interest their students in attending our law school.
So how did you do that?
And of course, In that process, I also emphasized to undergraduate schools our interest in minorities, you see. That worked out. And, of course, once we were permitted to have women, that fell in place too, you see. But the process was one of visiting dozens and dozens and dozens of undergraduate schools and telling them about Washington Lee Law School.
Now, did you go to a school, just any school, or did you go specifically to see a specific candidate?
I targeted schools.
Oh, okay.
I targeted schools. And then as I targeted schools and visited schools, I talked to students in those schools about our law school. And gradually, over a period of time, I was able to interest students from a considerable area of the country to give us a try here. And so there again, if you look at those catalogs, look at the catalog when I came here. See where the students came from. Then go through the catalogs from that point on and see what a change there was over the years.
Well, how did you target schools? What kind of schools did you target to bring in qualified blacks?
Well, that ain't easy. You can target all black undergraduate schools to try to interest them in coming here, but and I did. I visited any number of all black undergraduate schools with some degree of regularity to try to interest the students in coming here. We had some success gradually with that. But also, you will be able to make contact with minorities by visiting schools that aren't all black. For instance, there are some good black students at Swarthmore or at Princeton or here or there or wherever. And if you can make the contact with the good black student at those schools, you may have a shot at getting them to be interested in your school, you see?
And was that fairly unusual for the dean to be going out and recruiting on a one-to-one basis?
It was not. I'll put it this way: the top-tier law schools at the time I came here, the top-tier law schools were visiting undergraduate schools to try to build their ties to undergraduate schools and get a flow of students coming to the law school from those undergraduate schools. And at the University of Michigan, I had been active in the operations at that school with respect to making meaningful contacts with undergraduate schools for the purpose of stimulating good students to apply to the University of Michigan. Well, I simply carried on with that when I came to Washington Lee and used a lot of contacts that I had with good undergraduate schools to shift their focus from the University of Michigan to Washington Lee University. And I had a good deal of, many people who had a lot of confidence in me in these undergraduate schools who were happy to listen to my story. And for example, just show you what can happen. Bob Goodlatte, do you know who he is?
A representative?
Yes. He's a graduate of the law school here. Mm-hmm. Bob Goodlatte, I interviewed on one of my visits to Bowdoin University up in Maine, and interested Bob in coming down here to our law school. So Bob Goodlatte came down to our law school here in Virginia and liked it, and you can see what he's done with it. Now,
nope.
There are other stories that I just haven't tried to think of, but that just occurred to me.
What? Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. What was your sales pitch?
Well, there are a number of very prestigious law schools who are competing for good students who are coming out of undergraduate schools. You don't go out to undergraduate schools and knock other good law schools. That's the last thing you do. They're all good. They're all fine law schools. And what you have to do is talk about what your law school may have to offer that will not be found, perhaps, at other law schools. And certainly one of the things that I had in mind as we were developing this law school was that too many of the big, of the good law schools, the top-notch law schools in this country, had gotten far too large and impersonal. And one of the important things I thought to professional education was a personal touch in the educational process, where students knew the professors, where professors knew their students, where there was some real honest interaction between the students and the professors, because I think that means a lot in developing the professional attitudes that I want to see in young lawyers going out into the field. And so I felt that one of the great assets we would have once we were able to find a fine facility as a locus for it, one of the great things we would have to offer was that we would be a school with a first-rate library, a school with a first-rate faculty, but which was unique in that it was small enough that we could have this feeling of a community, which can't exist in these great big law schools. And so that was always one of the points I would make with people in the undergraduate schools, that this was something that was different about us. It wasn't for everyone, but there is something we have to offer that you can't find at other good law schools. And so if this appeals to a student, this is where he or she can find it, do you see? And that's the way you... I think that's one of the most important distinctions between this school and the other good law schools across the country. They all have good faculties, they all have good libraries, they all have nice buildings, but there's a spirit in this law school, because of its size, which can't be replicated at the University of Michigan's and the Harvard's and the Stanford's and so forth. They're too big.
So as you put a class together,
It must have been the only thing I can equate in my life is putting together the perfect dinner party where you invite just the right guests. Were you trying to pull together within a class a certain range of diversity?
No. I did want geographical diversity. I think we needed that. And certainly, I was interested in the minority situation. I was interested in the women's situation, and we got that fixed. But I was interested in geographical diversity. I was interested in differences in educational background of the students. I didn't want everyone to come from the University of Virginia. They're all going to be the same people. I didn't want them all to come to the University of Michigan. I wanted them to come from a lot of different undergraduate schools. Each of those undergraduate schools would have finished off that undergraduate in a slightly different way than the other schools, so that you had a somewhat different individual from school A, undergraduate school A, than at undergraduate school B. And what I wanted was a mix of students from a number of different undergraduate schools, so that when you brought them together, they would have had a fine educational experience at the school they attended, but also they would bring to this law school that background of a fine educational experience, but one which had a little different slant to it than the experience of the student at school B. And this enriches the experience of the students here when they are mixed together with all of those different educational experiences at different institutions, you see?
It makes perfect sense to me. Now, I would assume that in particular for minorities and for women, that it would be important to them to have diversity on the faculty, too.
That's right.
So you had to work at that as well, I
exactly,
assume.
Exactly. And we've worked on it. And I think we'll never quit working on it. I mean, they're going to always be trying to better the situation, but we do have some problems, particularly with respect to minority faculty, because it is not the easiest thing in the world to attract minority faculty to a small town like Lexington. They have lots of opportunities, and a lot of them are going to feel more comfortable connecting up with schools in metropolitan communities where they can also get a job. And while we can pay them as well as they'll be paid at those schools, they prefer to live in that urban environment. So it isn't easy to attract minority faculty. We work on it constantly. Now, as far as the gender thing is concerned, I think we've done a good job. We find a lot of fine female persons who can be interested in this community. It's safe, it's clean, it has a wonderful cultural environment and so forth. And they can be interested. We do pretty well, I think, on that score. But we have a way to go to get some more diversity on the minority faculty thing. But it's not an easy task.
So when you were recruiting minority students, Would they ask that question?
Oh, of course. And quite frankly, we have the same problem with respect to the minority student that we want to attract. Because, quite frankly, they're going to be more comfortable, by and large, attending a school that is in a more cosmopolitan, urban-type environment than our school. So it's not easy always to attract them, but...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have had increasingly good success attracting the minorities, particularly the blacks. I'm very proud of what I think we've been able to accomplish with some of the black students. We've got one black student that graduated from here who's now a judge in Georgia, one who graduated from here who is now a judge in Virginia. We've got one who is a member of the state legislature. We've got another black who was head of the Liquor Control Board here in Virginia. We've made a contribution to giving those students some opportunities.
Have any of them ever considered staying on the faculty?
Not during my tenure as dean, but what may have happened since I retired as dean, I just don't know about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you certainly opened this place up wide open compared to what it once was. Now, is there still preference given to Washington and Lee undergraduates who want to come here for law school?
No, there was not while I was dean. Mm-hmm. There was no preference. The one preference we gave them, and this is as it should be, I think, is that if a person qualified for the wait list, there are no preferences at all as far as you're making an in or making the wait list or out. That's without regard to preference.
Mm-hmm.
But once a person was on the wait list, then we thought it was perfectly proper if we had openings that occurred in the process of filling out the class, and we had to go to the wait list for that purpose, that it would be perfectly proper and indeed very appropriate for us to look at the fact that this is a Washington and Lee undergraduate, or this is the son of an alumnus of Washington and Lee Law School, or this is the daughter of a Washington and Lee Law School alumnus, you see? But only at that point.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And to that extent, yes, it can be helpful.
And so, I know we can't come up with exact statistics, but each year, about how many Washington and Lee 7-year people are there or were there?
Well, for a time, there were too few, but I think that has gradually improved. But as I say, they must meet the standards in order to be admitted, mm-hmm, with that slight preference given if they make the wait list. Otherwise, they've got to meet the standards. Now, I want to say this, that one problem you have with the undergraduate at Washington Lee and this law school at Washington Lee is that, quite understandably, a student who has been first rate in the undergraduate school will have opportunities to go to law schools other places than to Washington and Lee. And quite understandably, those top-notch students who have that choice often feel, and I have to support them in it, and I will tell them frankly, that's the way I feel, that if they have the choice, they may be better off going somewhere else for their law school experience so that they get into a new climate, a new atmosphere, and have to kind of start all over to do it in law school instead of just moving across to this law school. And so, quite frankly, we lose a lot of the best Washington and Lee law students who we'd love to have come to us and to whom we offer admission. But they rightly feel they're going to be better off going to another good law school in another locale to broaden themselves out. So that makes it tough for us.
I can tell you've put a lot of time and energy into this, and it's, the school is very grateful for it. I can tell you, you have mm-hmm. a fabulous reputation here mm-hmm. for what you've done here. Now, you mentioned a lot of new programs. What kind of new programs?
Well, here again, I wish you'd go to the catalogs, please. Take the catalogs in 1968 and 69 and 70. And compare them to the catalogs that we had in the middle 1980s, for example, mm-hmm. which was toward the end of my tenure, at the end of my tenure. Look at those catalogs. They're very instructive. But you'll see, and on that point, look and see the activities that are described in the catalog in 1968.
What kinds of things are you most proud of?
You have your moot court activities of various kinds. You have your legal aid activities of various kinds. You have your law review activities. And then you have student bar association activities. I don't think there was any legal aid at all when I came here. We built a legal aid organization in Lexington. We built a legal aid organization that gave legal aid to the people in the mental hospital up in Stanton. I got a program started with the support from Tom Clark, who was then the Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. Tom Clark helped me get a program started with the Federal Women's Prison over in Alderson, West Virginia, where we regularly give legal assistance to those women. You see, we built all of that up. And our moot court programs have grown in size and quality over the years. And the law review has always been a good law review. And I think that there hasn't been that dramatic a change there. Look at the catalog.
What exactly does the law review do?
Well, the law review is a legal journal written primarily for the profession, for lawyers. And it takes topics of generally speaking, takes topics of timely interest to the profession and to our society, not just the members of the profession, but to our society, and writes scholarly discussions of the pros and cons and so forth of those problems. That's generally what it does. Now, we, in the process, we get mature scholars who will contribute articles to our journal. And at the same time, one of the most important parts of the Law Review is that the students publish it. And they have their own editorial board that screens the articles from these scholars that they think are worthy of publication in our journal. And they edit those articles. They also supervise the preparation of smaller articles, which we call law review comments or notes, that are written by our students. And our students thus develop the ability to articulate their ideas and points of view in regard to important, timely legal topics. And if they do that and do it well, they will be published in our journal, do you see?
So how many students get involved with the Law Review?
I think you'll have to ask them how it's grown since I came here. But check that with Sally. Sally will know. She'll have the data.
Okay. Do all schools have a law review?
Yes. No, not all schools, but all good schools do. All good schools have a law review.
I know I've seen that it's used as a selling point for the school that we have a law review.
That's right. But all good schools have a law review. And it's quite a distinction for a student to be selected to be a member of the Law Review.
Who does that selecting?
Students themselves. It's a student-run organization. And that's the interesting and important thing about it. It's a prestigious, each of these law reviews of the good schools is a prestigious legal publication that is student-run and operated. And it teaches our students a lot of responsibility and care in their legal thought and legal articulation of their ideas and so on.
Are there any particular women graduates that you're particularly proud of who've gone on to do extraordinary things?
Well, I hate just, if I had thought about it, I could have developed this. Just off the top of my head, I hesitate to try to describe male or female students who have particularly distinguished themselves. Now, I did happen to think of the good laddie, the good lad idea, because it occurred to me that he had come to us from Bolden and I had contacted him up there. But good lad is just one of dozens of students who have gone out and distinguished themselves in our profession. I just have to take a little time to refresh my mind on it. And certainly there are some women who have equally distinguished themselves as they've gone out into the profession. I'm just not pulling something off the top of my head right now.
Okay. Now, one last thing from my point of view that we haven't really talked about is how you got around to do all this kind of thing. You have a name around here as the Flying Dean.
Yes,
tell me about that.
Yes. Well, I found that my airplane was one of the greatest assets imaginable for purposes of my doing all of the things I needed to do with respect to helping out these things I wanted to accomplish at the law school, because it gave me tremendous mobility, and it was invaluable to me. And I must say that I enjoyed the flying experience. I flew for 34 years, they have the old saying, there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots. And just to show you where I fit into that, I quit flying when I was 76 years old, so you can see that I was not a bold pilot. But in those 34 years, I had a ball because I enjoyed flying a great deal, and as I say, that helped me a great deal in visiting undergraduate schools, contacts with bar organizations around the country, and so forth, you see. And I did a fair amount of flying. As a matter of fact, I quit flying when I was 76 years old. And I still had my current physical ticket. I still had my current proficiency ticket. You're examined every 2 years for flight proficiency. I was current in all those things, but I finally decided that enough was enough. I ought to quit while I was ahead. And so I gave it up at 76.
And you're here to tell the tale.
That's right. But I enjoyed every minute of it, and as I say, it really was invaluable to me, that flying, to do the things I had to do.
Would you go alone, or did anybody else in the school go
with
you?
I occasionally took faculty with me on certain missions, but normally these were things where I was just doing it on myself, on my own. You know, I flew a lot of hours by myself. Matter of fact, I ended up with a little over 5,000 solo hours as pilot in command of my aircraft.
Wow.
And that's quite a few hours.
I dare say. Well, I see that we're about at the end of the tape. Is there anything you'd like to say at the end of this interview?
No, I think you've done a good job in trying to cover these things better than I have done in responding, but...